In the infinite inning, no one ever learns anything. If you look at most any baseball history book, there will be a striking photograph of a Major League Baseball stadium almost completely underwater. That picture is from January 1937, when the Ohio River, swollen to 80 feet after about 2 weeks of heavy rain, flooded the city of Cincinnati. It was one of the biggest natural disasters in the history of the country to that point, with the city fathers forced to open the floodgates to let in some of the water, lest the river top the barriers and sweep in and wash everything in its path away. As it was, the current somehow caused oil storage to rupture and ignite, and the water caught fire. The Reds' ballpark, Crosley Field, was near a tributary of the river, Mill Creek. For close to 100 years, Mill Creek had been kind of an industrial sewer for the city, and it flooded too and drowned the ballpark in 21 feet of water. Perhaps that doesn't sound like a lot to you, but it was enough to submerge pretty much the whole ballpark. And as if to emphasize that condition, there's another picture that appears in a lot of baseball books. It's Crosley Field during that same flood, but we're in close to the field now, and two men in a rowboat are floating around about where the pitcher's mound should be. One of them is Reds pitcher Lee Grissom, and the other is the team's traveling secretary, John McDonald, and Grissom is waving his hat. I guess you would wave your hat, too, if you had just followed the path of a home run backwards by boat. They had rowed down the street, over the left field wall, and across the field to about where they thought the mound would be. Hooray! I guess that's looking on the bright side. Hey, we're going to be in this stadium at some point, even if we've got to play water polo, so hang in there. Indeed, although Grissom couldn't have known it at the time, the Reds had been relatively lucky. The ballpark was only damaged by its severe irrigation, not destroyed. The Mill Creek didn't have a current, so it didn't batter the structure, it only drowned it. The cost came to $25,000 or $30,000 in 1937 money, which is still quite a lot, but it didn't leave them homeless. "We had 10 to 40 men patrolling the field in rowboats night and day," said team president Warren Giles. "They kept dragging the floating oil drums, whiskey casks, auto tires, timbers, packing cases, and so on away from the stands and clubhouse before they could do damage. Yes, I passed much time myself on the rowboat patrol." The park was ready for opening day that year, and in fact, the whole city had gotten off light, if you consider 12 square miles flooded, 10 deaths, thousands homeless, and millions of dollars of damage light. The flood, which had caused damage up and down the river, not just in Cincinnati, took about 500 lives overall and left hundreds of thousands homeless. Since then, in part as a reaction to that particular flood, the government, via the Army Corps of Engineers, has put in all kinds of preventative measures so that the same circumstances are less likely to recur. And other than 1997, when really heavy rains came again, I believe they largely haven't. That year, 97, the waters surrounded Synergy Field, formerly known as Riverfront, but thanks to pumps and floodgates, it didn't come in. If you think about it, even with that example, we have several stadiums located in the vicinity of large bodies of water. No doubt it's a more picturesque setting than putting the ballpark above the landfill, and you'd rather see a player homer out to the wet blue horizon than towards the parking garages that dominate the view at Nationals Park, just to give you one example. Still, it wasn't necessarily the smartest thing in the world in 1937. Actually, in 1884, the Reds had been playing in that same spot in a succession of different ballparks, including the wonderfully named Palace of the Fans, going back to 1884. And in an age of rising seas and weather systems disrupted by global warming, it's not any more brilliant now than it was then. Back in February, the Tampa Bay Rays identified the location that they want to move to if they ever get a new ballpark financed. It's in the Ybor neighborhood of Tampa, which is not far from the similarly named Ybor Channel. A channel being a path in from the water that has been carved out from the land so that ships can get in closer to town than they might otherwise. Which is one of those things which is good until it's not good. From the vantage point of one who has not been to that part of Tampa, it does seem like a great location, notwithstanding that you wouldn't have AT&T park-style splashdown home runs, because while it's close to the water, it's not that close. There's a highway that would cut the stadium off from the waterfront, and there's a little bit of land there. It's hard for me to tell how much. I do not think it would be a significant amount of land if, say, for whatever reason, the water chose to overflow its current boundaries. According to a July 2017 article in the Washington Post, rising sea levels make Tampa one of the cities in the world most vulnerable to climate change. I mean, all of Florida is, being a peninsula, it's surrounded on, by definition, three sides of water, but Tampa, which is right there on the coast and adjacent to the Gulf of Mexico, the playground of hurricanes, is an especially bad spot. You don't need a study in a newspaper to tell you that. It's just obvious. In the article, there's a lot of talk about what would happen if Tampa were to be hit by a Category 5 storm. Well, any city in the country would be in serious trouble if it were to be hit by a Category 5 storm. That's equally obvious. It's just that Tampa is a lot more likely to be hit by a Category 5 storm by virtue of its location than, say, New York City or Denver. Now, I'm no meteorologist, so I can't tell you if conditions mean that Tampa is less likely than, say, New Orleans to be a target for a major hurricane, but ballpark-wise, they're in the same place. They share the same body of water, just many miles apart. Hurricane Irma, which showed up about a month after the Post article ran, didn't quite give Tampa a direct hit. In fact, they had a negative storm surge, which is to say that the water went out, so flooding wasn't as extensive as it might have been. It was just a really bad day for the local manatees. That said, a map in the Post article suggests that the ballpark would be located in an area where a Category 5 hurricane might throw up 20 feet of water or more. And forget the hurricanes. If sea levels rise as much in the next dozen or 15 years as they're expected to, the water from the Ybor Channel port might end up lapping the left field seats. I'm sure that when, as, and if the Rays get to build their ballpark, they'll equip it with all possible protections from the nearby Gulf, extra thick walls, pumps, so on. Maybe they can elevate it a bit, you know, put it on pylons. It just seems unlikely that a team that it seems will barely have enough money to build, if they ever get it, will add cost to the project that wouldn't be there if you built at an inland location. It also seems like tempting fate to fight for so long to get this precious jewel of a ballpark financed and then perch it on a metaphorical cliff. How do you even get that park insured? We human beings never seem to accept that things aren't as controllable as we want them to be. You know, we built the Titanic, the unsinkable ship, and maybe, just maybe, we'll build the unsinkable ballpark, or at least as unsinkable as the Titanic was. It won't be unsinkable. It can't be unsinkable. Even if the technology to make it more water-resistant has improved, if things have changed in that way, so has the weather. We can't take it for granted anymore. They have an amusement park in the Cincinnati area called Coney Island. As the flood in 1937 hit the merry-go-round, the painted carousel horses were pulled out of their places and, as a herd, bobbed off down the river, swimming in search of a place where childish laughter would be uninterrupted by the lapping of the waves. I imagine they recovered those carousel horses eventually, once the waters had receded, and you can nail them down in place. But if the river is determined to free them again, there'll be no holding them back. And perhaps this time, those garish, haunted horses will make their way, unmotivated by human hands, but propelled by a force far greater, will find themselves adrift in the outfield, awaiting riders who will never reach them. I'm Stephen Goldman, and this is the Infinite Inning Baseball Podcast. Hi, Mom. Hi, Lori. How was school today?
It was great. I joined a cult.
A what?
A cult. The Assassins of Dancing Midnight. It's like yoga club, only with killing.
That can't be right, Lori.
It was Miss Samuelson's idea. She says she's tired of just being a student advisor and the cheerleading coach. Now she wants to be our high priestess. She's so cool.
I don't know if I approve of this, Lori.
Why, Mom?
Killing is wrong.
It's not that wrong.
Well, it's pretty wrong, and I don't think a cult will look as good on your college transcript as chess club.
But, Mom, I'm so embarrassed. All the kids are joining cults now.
Well, what other cults are there? There's the Spinning Sisters of the Sharpened Needle.
Doesn't sound like Harvard material, dear.
The Worshippers of My Dark Lord Thune?
No.
What about Episode 51?
Oh, Lori, I like that. Is there still killing in that?
There might be, Mom.
If there is, do you think I might kill somebody too?
Admit it, you've all known a family or two just like this one. Welcome back to the show. I'm joined this week, for the third time, but for the first time in a long time, by Craig Calcaterra of NBC's Hardball Talk. We assess the start of the 2018 season, some highs, some lows, and some tanking. And I do want to point out that although we kept coming back, I think I in particular kept coming back to the Cincinnati Reds as an example of a team that is just not trying, that is ostensibly in a rebuild, but does not seem to be efforting particularly strongly in the direction of a conclusion to that rebuild. We did not know at the time of our discussion that the Reds would be firing their manager and pitching coach and at least making a cosmetic change to what has been a truly dreadful 1935 Boston Braves-like start of the season at this recording. They are 3-15, and actually that's an insult to the 1935 Boston Braves, who weren't quite that bad. Now, nobody goes 3-15, that's a 167 winning percentage over the course of a whole season. They'll blunder into some wins by accident, practically, and Joey Votto hasn't started hitting, and you would expect that he would, and that would just by itself make things a lot better. But nevertheless, they were our example, and by firing their manager, they seem to agree with us, at least in some aspects of things. Before I get to the story I usually tell in this spot, I do want to inform you that after much procrastination on my part, and despite my general discomfort with Facebook, which, well, preceded many revelations about their data-keeping habits, I have begun a Facebook discussion group. It may just be me right now, but I've begun it, and I welcome you all to come in and talk to me or talk to each other or talk about things that come up in the course of these episodes that you might find worthy of further exploration. You can find it by going to Facebook and searching on The Infinite Inning. It's a public group. You apply for membership, I let you in, and then you can chatter away. I just ask so that I don't have to worry about moderation, and because I would just like this of an infinite inning community, that we be kind to each other. I always tell my loved ones that we may disagree. In fact, we will disagree. It is inevitable that we will disagree about certain things. But even in the heat of the moment, we must remember that we love each other and that disagreements are transient, but that love is eternal. And hopefully in that way, we remember to check ourselves when we are tempted to say the hurtful thing, the angry thing, the biting thing, that wonderfully slashing comment that always comes to mind when you're ticked off. So, enough said about that. I hope that the discussion group is a positive and that all of you many listeners who have written me or said something on Twitter or have just silently lurked and listened all this time, I thank you all for that, and I do hope that you will find each other as pleasant company as I hope you find me,
which, wonderfully, is more pleasant company than I find me. But then that's kind of the nature of the infinite inning, isn't it? I've been thinking a lot about the term witch hunt. Witch hunt, the dictionary defines, paraphrasing a few entries in various dictionaries, as an intensive effort to ferret out subversion, disloyalty, or treason based on scant evidence. The term only dates from about 1925 or 1930, which means the actual witch hunters in Europe or Salem, Massachusetts didn't use that term, and that makes sense. They wouldn't have, because they believed in the reality of what they were doing. In their mind, they found witches. It's only later, once we realize they were, shall we say, misguided, that there was a generation of old ladies who were calumnied and sometimes killed in pursuit of something mythological. Killed is entirely too passive. Let's say murdered in pursuit of something mythological. That the term would have made sense. It really caught on in the late 40s and 50s as the second Red Scare took hold of the American consciousness and people were looking for communists everywhere. As Bob Dylan sang in his Talking John Birch Society Blues, even in the toilet bowl, they got away, Bob said. This was the same period when the Cincinnati Reds changed their names to Red Legs because a red is a full communist, whereas a red leg is only a communist from the waist down. No, it doesn't make sense to me either, but those were different times. Insofar as I know, no members of, say, the 1949 Reds were communists. Racists, maybe, but not communists. Ted Kluczewski was not distributing Trotsky pamphlets in the clubhouse. At least I don't think he or any other member of the team was. But Gabe Paul, who was running the Reds then, felt that it was necessary to, I don't know, prevent Joe McCarthy from coming after them. Again, strange times. Paul started this in 1953, and I guess he had no way of knowing that McCarthy's power would break in 1954. That was the year which, at the instigation of Roy Cohn, he took on the army and lost. Those were the hearings at which Joe Welch famously said, "Have you no sense of decency, sir? At long last, have you no sense of decency?" And as McCarthy's poll numbers flipped from super positive to super negative, senators who never would have crossed him before voted to censure him that December, so Paul was catching the bandwagon just as the horse pulling it died. The neat thing about terms like witch hunts is that they can be turned around and embraced by those that the term was initially meant to indict. In the late 1940s, the actor Adolphe Manjou, who, if you're a movie buff, you might remember from the original version of The Front Page, or even the Shirley Temple film Little Miss Marker, or Stanley Kubrick's harrowing Paths of Glory, which, if you haven't seen, I greatly recommend. It deserves to be as well remembered as 2001, or The Shining, or Spartacus, or his naked Tom Cruise orgy movie. Despite a name that sounds like some kind of German-French rapprochement, he was actually all-American, born in Pittsburgh, and really hated those commies. And when HUAC came along, he was big on naming whatever names he knew, or could at least throw aspersions at. And he said, "I am a witch hunter, if the witches are communists." That actually makes less sense than if he had said something like, "Extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice," which Barry Goldwater actually said while running for president about a dozen years later. Just because you can name the object of your obsession doesn't legitimize it as an object. Going back to our definition of witch hunt, if witch hunt is meant to imply a fervid search for enemies who aren't really there, then whether you're acting in pursuit of communists or not, to identify oneself as a witch hunter is to identify oneself with delusion. In fact, if you can rationalize that tangle of thoughts, you are in a bad place. You are a little crazy. And indeed, the country was a little crazy at that time, because one of the ironies of the Red Scare McCarthyist period is that between laws like the Smith Act and the McCarran Act, which criminalized a great deal of just associating with communists, talking about communism, and you can throw in Harry Truman's loyalty program, in which the government investigated itself to purge any possible communist influence, the party was broken, its leadership was driven deeply underground, and whatever little influence it had, had dissipated. The Smith Act made it a crime to advocate the violent overthrow of the United States government. And the way it was written and the way prosecutions were brought, you really didn't need to have done anything at all in terms of an actual deed. And you didn't even need to have made an explicit call for violent revolution. You just needed to have
expressed or in some way had an affiliation with communism. So let's say in the 1930s, you attended some meetings that are later deemed sketchy by some people. Somebody reports you to the FBI. You're arrested and you're put on trial. You say, "What did I do?" They say, "Are you now or have you ever been a member of the Communist Party?" You say, "No, I only expressed an appreciation for some of their ideas." And at that point, the prosecutor says, "Ha-ha," and he pulls out a book of the writings of Lenin and turns to some dog-eared page. On page 29, Lenin says that the government will be overthrown by the proletariat. This is the essence of communism. So if you say you like communism, it means you like this. Case closed. And at that point, the jury convicts you and you're either sent to federal prison or deported. That is a witch hunt and how a witch hunt finds things. It rigs things in Kafkaesque fashion. When there's actual evidence of something having been done, even if that evidence does not eventually bear out the crime that is being looked for, it is by definition not a witch hunt. You can't demonstrate witchism in a factual way, but you can, using evidence, put a certain person at a certain place at a particular time with another person, and you can say, "Hey, this guy was with Professor Plum in the billiards room with the lead pipe when the murder was committed." It doesn't mean he was an accessory to Professor Plum. It doesn't mean that he handed him the lead pipe. It might not mean that he participated in the crime at all. But at least you have a legitimate basis for further investigation. Whereas, other than the traditional dunking test of a witch, which isn't a test at all, it's just torture, you can't show that a witch is a witch. The only thing you can do is have somebody make an accusation and have other people go along with it, despite its lack of factual underpinning. You have to resort to insinuation. You have to resort to causal chains that don't make a whole lot of sense when they're examined. It leads to reasoning that is not reasoning. It is, in fact, insane. Example that touches on baseball. In 1956, the U.S. Information Agency was supporting a touring art exhibit called, appropriately, Sport in Art. It had been assembled by Sports Illustrated magazine to coincide with that year's Olympic Games in Australia. It had gone all over the country, but as the exhibit reached Dallas, Texas, a group calling itself the Dallas County Patriotic Council insisted that the show was subversive because some of the artists included had belonged to what they deemed communist front organizations. None of the artists had been named as communists. None of them had professed communist beliefs, but they had been connected with these groups that this group insisted were bad. This was in the same period that Congressman George Dondero of Michigan spoke on the House floor of brainwashed artists in uniform of the Red Art Brigade. In that case, he was referring to a show mounted at a United States Navy hospital in St. Albans, New York, for the benefit of paraplegic veterans, i.e., let's give these guys who aren't moving around a lot something cool to look at. The show was suddenly canceled because some of the artists were individuals of known left-wing affiliations. Their art was designed to cut the people adrift from the ancient moorings of exacting standards, good taste, common sense, the anchorage of tradition. Dondero called that show a great opportunity not only to spread propaganda, but to engage in espionage. Yeah, but how could art do that? Well, he said, art which does not portray our beautiful country in plain, simple terms that everyone can understand breeds dissatisfaction. It is therefore opposed to our government, and those who create and promote it are our enemies. Out of 100 pieces of art, the Dallas County Patriotic Council fixated on just 4. Among them, a drawing, and you can Google this, it's out there, called The National Pastime by Ben Shawn, depicting a batter at the plate. They also objected to a painting of people skating on a lake in a city park by Leon Kroll, a watercolor of a fisherman by William Zorach, and a skating scene by Yasuo Kuniyoshi. If you can find politics in these images, and again, they're all available online, you are out of your bleeping mind. The Patriotic Council anticipated that charge, saying, We're not interested in the nationality or political bent of the artist, nor are we interested in the quality or merit of the production, nor in the controversy between traditional versus modernistic art. All we're interested in is this. We don't want the exhibition in any public building of works by artists with communist front records. Somehow, by showing people skating or a batter at the plate, the museum would be promoting communism and the violent overthrow of the government of the United States. The exhibition had already toured around the country without there being any mass outbreaks of revolution, and three of the four pictures had been loaned by prominent museums, including the Museum of Modern Art in New York, that had had them on the walls on and off for years. But maybe the locals felt Dallas was uniquely vulnerable. The exhibition couldn't even give, by virtue of greater exposure, a platform to the artists involved because two of the four were dead at that time. And again, the causal relationships that were supposed to exist between a picture of a baseball player and disloyalty to the United States are hard to figure. Just that you could associate the artist in some faint way with leftist ideas made them ripe for a certain kind of persecution by people for whom persecution was their thing. Paranoia is self-justifying. It needs no evidentiary support. This came up in the Supreme Court deliberations over those Smith Act prosecutions. Justice William O. Douglas, who dissented from the court's initial approval of those prosecutions, characterized this sort of quote-unquote reasoning as, "The gremlins are gonna get ya." The directors of the Dallas Museum of Fine Arts, finding themselves under attack, wrote a public letter about these artists and their policies, saying that they didn't know and they didn't care what the politics of the artists were, that as far as they knew, they were not communists, but even if they were, well, hell, Picasso said he was a communist, and we're not taking down our Picasso, sorry, and neither is anybody else. They also said, and I quote, "It is important, once and for all time, to dissipate this nonsense that any single group in our community is the custodian of the patriotism of the rest of us. We believe that democracy cannot survive if subjected to book burning, thought control, condemnation without trial, proclamation of guilt by association, the very techniques of communist and fascist regimes." The Patriotic Council responded by calling the directors communist dupes. And the United States government bought their argument. The art did not go to Australia. The USIA canceled the tour, claiming that they had changed their plans due to overall budgetary considerations. If you've been exposed to an American history textbook, you've probably seen Ben Shahn's paintings of Sacco and Vanzetti, whose arrest, trial, and execution troubled him, as it did many Americans in the 1920s, among them the great baseball writer Haywood Bruin, the man who wrote the immortal line, "The Ruth is mighty and shall prevail." He made the case one of his personal causes. As for Shahn's piece from the exhibition, it's utterly apolitical. It's a black and white drawing of a batter swinging caught in full extension. The batter, the catcher, and the umpire are all superimposed on each other in a kind of scrawled jumble, signifying, I think, to the extent that I'm any kind of art critic, the chaos of the moment when everything happens at once. To be honest, the picture is not really my cup of tea as far as my personal taste in art goes, but I get what Shahn was attempting, and I think he achieved it. If nothing else, the drawing is kinetic. But unless you're thinking about Shahn as some kind of evil person to begin with, you can't see anything in it but baseball, and then the rest comes down to your personal taste or artistic criterion. If you came in ignorant of his politics, you'd go out the same way. Hell, you might go out ignorant about baseball too. One author writing contemporaneously about this controversy and others like it called them still life with red herring, or, you know, a witch hunt. Ideas are flexible. A term once invoked in the defense of an innocent minority can be used to impugn the legitimate pursuit of the guilty. In 1993, Marge Schott, then the 64-year-old owner of the Cincinnati Reds, was barred from running her team for the entirety of the season. The reason was that, both publicly and privately, she had said a number of racist and anti-Semitic things, including about her own African-American players. I'm not going to repeat those things here. They're easy enough to find if you want to find them. I just don't feel like making my brain and mouth say those terms. Despite what Marge said, despite her appreciation for Nazi memorabilia, she didn't believe in racism. I think sometimes it's created by the press, and that it really isn't there, she said of the unequal treatment of people on the basis of the color of their skin. This is actually the answer to the question, a racist says what? Bud Selig and the rest of the powers running baseball did believe in racism, didn't think it was a creation of the press, did believe that what she said was wrong. So, although they didn't make her sell the team, which is always a high bar, and they did allow her to attend Reds games, she couldn't sit in her on-field owner's box, she couldn't tell Jim Bowden, who temporarily took over the franchise, what to do, and Schott, who had no life outside of being this chiseling, penny-counting, erratic dictator of this little baseball team, whose operation she shrunk down to the bare bones, was devastated. You know what she called baseball's investigation of her? You guessed it. A witch hunt. And now we pause. Here there be sponsors. I'll be back in just a moment with Craig Calcaterra. My next conversational sparring partner is the voice of NBC's Hardball Talk, which is critics say is the leading social justice site in the baseball demi-monde, but for me is the perfect mix of insight and humor. You can call him Craig America, but when he's not working, he's simply Craig Calcaterra. How are you, Craig?
Doing great. How are you?
I'm fine. I hope you don't mind that social justice joke. I enjoy...
Oh, no. It's not a joke. It's actually telling you. You've unwittingly revealed my agenda to everyone that baseball is just a red herring.
The fifth column will come through baseball. I believe that's in the red channels and the fifth internationale or something. I don't really understand that because a lot of what you say is common sense. And I don't want to give anybody who doesn't read Hardball Talk regularly. And if you don't, what's wrong with you? But what it is, I think about this constantly, actually, Craig, and not just where you're concerned, but stuff I talk about here or write about and other people do too, is that the sabermetric mind is by definition reality based and is perhaps less swayed by pure appeals to class or patriotism or loyalty to something other than just the reality of things. So when you and baseball come upon a topic that overlap with people's political sensitivities, say the Chief Wahoo thing, which I've also written about extensively and talked about here, there's only one real direction for you to go, I think, and not betray what we do when we're talking about numbers and other baseball things that are purely between the lines.
I think there's some truth to that. I do find myself clashing quite often and increasingly with more sabermetrically oriented people or readers who certainly came up reading sabermetric stuff in some ways, because I don't think that there is a huge disconnect necessarily between certain conservative thought and where sabermetric thinking can take you in certain ways. Numbers are numbers. Numbers are not political, but you know, you've seen it, I've seen it, we've all seen it, and have been talking about it in the baseball world about how following certain sabermetric principles or working just on the numbers and taking the humanity out of it or taking the subjectivity out of it can lead you to a lot of weird places, like, you know, being a very pro front office, heartless kind of person. It doesn't have to, but we see that, right? And so when I start talking about liberal stuff, or when I start talking more increasingly about labor stuff in the liberal talk, it really bugs people when my view isn't about the sheer baseball efficiency argument for a given move or a given transaction or a given position that a front office has taken. So I find myself clashing actually with the people who used to be my bestest buddies in the world, philosophically speaking. So it's been an interesting journey for about the past 15 years.
So you mean, I first thought you were referring to
the controversy, say, over minor leaguers getting something like a minimum wage. And people argue about that based on, I feel like, the faulty assumption that every single minor leaguer gets a zillion-dollar bonus and is set for life the moment that they sign. But you will also mean that, say, if, you know, middle reliever John Smith is released, you might, I don't recall your having said this exactly, but like, think of John Smith's family. Think of John Smith's kids having to relocate from sunny San Diego to Detroit. That's a human analysis of it. But of course, teams don't make decisions on that basis. And maybe some fans don't either.
There's a little bit of that. I mean, when you mention the, you know, the human side of it, that certainly sets people off. I don't know that I've gone too deeply into maybe that level of argument. Like, I won't say, oh, just think how sad this guy is. I think of it personally sometimes, but you can't really go into that very much. But I think more along the lines of, you know, with the Atlanta Braves keeping Ronald Acuna down for service time manipulation purposes. Clearly, that's what they're doing. They want to make sure they have an extra year of control for him. And sabermetric thinking and efficiency thinking will bring you to the position of, well, of course they do that. They'd be idiotic not to do that. It's all about money and it's all about team control of a player, and he is an asset. And I totally understand that from a baseball analysis point of view. And I used to, you know, live that and argue that up and down constantly about this is the smart thing for the front office to do. And I am increasingly of the view of, okay, that might be the smart thing to do, but is it the right thing to do? Is it cosmically the right thing to do? What about what they're doing with someone? They are costing this guy a lot of money, and they're costing this guy a year of professional freedom. And maybe we should care about that as fans. The front office shouldn't care about that. The Braves are committing malpractice if they don't maximize their Ronald Acuna control. But we don't have to be the front office. And that's where I get into fights with people, in that sabermetrics, fantasy baseball, I think I would argue even computer simulation games from the 80s on, increasingly put fans in the position of the general manager. We're playing fantasy general manager, not fantasy baseball. And the assumption that that's the only way that you could look at issues in baseball from that perspective is rampant. It's crazy. People don't even, I think, examine it very much. But almost every conversation I have in baseball with fans and my readers, they are assuming that they are Theo Epstein and not that they are a fan with their own interests and their own values.
It occurs to me then that the secret way, I hope they don't listen to this, this is the only the only time I will wish for fewer listeners, is that instead of having people play baseball mogul or out of the park or whatever management simulation, that the Ayn Rand, Paul Ryan people of the world would sway people to their worldview if they all played coal mine mogul. And you would have a certain number of acceptable losses among your laborers, your miners and so on, from lung disease and industrial accidents. And you'd constantly be trying to negotiate with the coal miners union to tamp down wages. And eventually you would just totally be subsumed in the management point of view.
Well, I don't know. I haven't played SimCity since like the early 90s, but the old version of SimCity was certainly, can I maximize the amount of money in my coffers if I put the residential area next to the nuclear power plant? Will that work? And if not, here's the cheat code to embezzle. That's actually a pretty realistic sim of a lot of what goes on these days.
I used to play baseball mogul quite a bit. And then as it got more and more realistic, it got more and more like a full-time job. The ratio of time to accomplishing stuff, not just playing a season, but as the season ended, it was, okay, now it's time to deal with contract options. Okay, now it's time to go to arbitration. Like it got to be so, there was so much prep to actually play a season. It was actually a lot like the off season we just went through. So I don't necessarily understand. I mean, you'd think that would be disabusing people of the notion that it's a romantic or easy job to have. And, you know, you'd have people calling radio talk shows saying, no, I played one of these simulations. We can't second guess the general manager quite as easily as we normally do. One thing that I was thinking about as we were talking about this and the human side of baseball is that in the 70s, there was this outfielder, not a particularly great player, but his name was Walt No Neck Williams. And he finished with the Yankees in 1975, and he was released somewhere mid-season. And somehow there was a photographer in the clubhouse at the exact moment that he had been told he was cut. And it is the most devastating picture of just pure despondency on the part of a human being. And if you actually see a picture like that, it's so much harder to just look at things on a pure baseball basis and pretend that these are just baseball cards that you're dealing with and you can shuffle them anywhere and there not be consequences to it.
Oh, yeah, completely. And again, I think I'm the sort of fan who grew up at a time where you didn't see that stuff. I didn't live in a major league city, so I wasn't even if I were going to be reading the papers then, I didn't read the human interest stories about so-and-so and player and what he and his wife do in the off season. I didn't necessarily see those great photographs. I was looking at stat lines and sporting news. And then, you know, on Wednesday and Thursday in the USA Today, and I was playing my simulation games and I was sorting baseball cards and I was listening on the radio or watching games on TV, but the players, to my adolescent mind, in a lot of ways were avatars, right? I mean, they were video game characters. I got to meet a few at card shows and things like that, but they just seemed like gods. They didn't seem like humans. And the idea that, and I don't think I'm alone. I think a lot of people grow up like that, and maybe increasingly so in the last 20 years. I have no idea. But the human interest story appeal and all of that tends not to appeal towards younger people as much as it does towards people who've lived a little bit. You certainly can't empathize or put yourself in the shoes of someone at the end of their baseball career unless you too have suffered some setbacks or found, you know, some places in your life where you've changed. It's just very difficult, I think, for a random kid anywhere to connect with athletes, professional athletes, or movie stars, or what have you, as human beings. I mean, they should. We all should. But I don't know that the system is set up to deliver them to us that way. And I think it makes it very easy for someone to yell insults at a player or to not think of their feelings or anything else. And we can go too far with that. I don't think people will come and read my website if I spend every post talking about, but, you know, how does Tommy Pham feel about his groin not being good today? how does that, you know, we can go too far, but there's something I think missing in baseball and all sports fandom when it comes to that kind of thing.
I believe it was Nietzsche who wrote about not gazing into your groin pole, lest your groin pole gaze into you. So it's probably better that you don't. So just to ask as broad as possible a question, you can answer this in any way. The 2018 season, how do you like it so far?
Not much. I mean, the obvious thing is obviously the weather. The weather has sucked. It's hard for me personally to get into baseball. I live in Ohio, so it's been cold and terrible. And it's like January 105th here today. And so it's very difficult for me to get into baseball mode when I have my fireplace on and I'm freezing. It's hard for me, even if my weather is a little better, to watch guys playing in 32 degrees and, you know, all the off days and the rhythm's just been bad. I think everybody's been complaining about that a little bit. On another level, and this is more my fault than anything else, because I don't think anything has changed much early in this season compared to last season or the season before, but I've become hyper aware of relief pitcher usage because it's something I thought about a lot in the offseason. The World Series certainly put us in the mindset of bullpenning. In the offseason, the relievers were getting signed, but other players weren't. And there are all this talk about the importance of relief pitching. And so I've been very, very aware of just how much relief pitching has been utilized in the early going. There were 15 pitchers used in a 12-inning game on Tuesday. I think Dodgers game maybe. And I can't remember which one, but there were 15 pitchers used. That seems excessive to me. Not just because of the pace of play or the length of games. I don't care about that so much. Just because I like baseball. I came to baseball with a love of starting pitching that has always been my sort of way into the game in a narrative way. Is I think of every game, or like to anyway, as a battle between two starting pitchers and a game that builds. And at some point, one breaks and the other one doesn't. And we just don't have that anymore. Or maybe we do and it only lasts five innings. Or maybe I'm just being an old fogey about it. But I'm just having a very difficult time right now, as opposed to even a year ago, getting into the modern rhythm of baseball. And I got to find some peace with that because I don't think it's changing anytime soon. I don't see any way that it will. But it is a bit of a bummer, I will say.
That's something I've struggled with, too. And one of the ironies of the war on pace of play, or whatever Rob Manfred calls that he's doing, or the war for the pace of play, is that the quickest way to attack that would be to limit mid-inning pitching changes or the number of pitchers available on a given day. So we didn't have the kind of thing that you're talking about, which is more and more typical where you have these double figure pitcher usages. And I haven't rechecked this since the first couple of weeks of the season. I mean, we're not that much further than that, but there were teams that had a deficit of starting pitching innings versus relief innings. And that's never happened. It's never been that a relief staff has pitched more innings than a starting rotation in a season. There have been some teams that have come fairly close as we've gone through time, but it's never been overbalanced towards the bullpen. And it seems like, as you said, with bullpenning, the knowledge that the third time through the order thing, that a starting pitcher, it doesn't matter who it is, Clayton Kershaw or the worst pitcher on your staff, he's going to be less effective for the most part. And that's one of these things that we've known forever, but somehow suddenly penetrated the collective mind of baseball. You can't legislate against that knowledge.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I'm stumped because you start making rules like the ones you suggest about mid-inning pitching changes. Well, guys labor, right? And guys who are laboring might be more at risk of injury, and that's not good. You can't do anything like that. And as with any other rule you make, there are unintended consequences and ways to weaponize the rule and everything. It will create some major changes. And I'm by no means a baseball purist or a nostalgic guy or anything like that. But, you know, there is a fundamental difference between changing some weird rule about technique and weird rule about the four corners of the game, as opposed to changing the essence of the game and the ability for managers and players to make choices and do things. And so you start talking about you can only change pitching so many times. That's very different than this is the technique you can use to slide into second base. So, you know, it is a can of worms. I don't know that there's any great way to deal with it. All I know is I really love the idea of a pitcher, you know, heading into the eighth inning and you wondering, can he get a few more outs? And I just don't know that we're going to see as much of that as we used to ever again. I don't know how we change it.
The Mets and Mickey Callaway found that out with Jacob DeGrom the other day.
Yeah, 7 1/3, and that third was bad right the other night.
But let me turn that on its head. When you talk about the essential nature of baseball, for a long time, the starting pitcher pacing himself was part of that. Christy Mathewson wrote a book, or had a book ghosted for him, called Pitching in a Pinch. And the nature of that wasn't that Christy Mathewson was saying, I'm great at pitching in the clutch. The pinch was what you paced yourself to get to. You were saving your stuff so that when the bases were loaded with two outs, you could reach back for the extra mile on your fastball and strike the guy out. So that was always part of baseball strategy. If you are changing the game such that it's five innings of a starting pitcher with four guys who can throw 100 mile an hour, just doing it all out for their three batters, or even one batter sometimes if it's a lefty, that is actually a fundamentally different game than it was, I would say, from basically 18 something to, let's say, Dennis Eckersley around 1990.
Yeah, I would agree. The max effort thing is a huge, huge thing. I mean, velocities are up, and I don't think it's all because we have physical freaks now. And some of it is because of that, but a lot of it is because the idea of pace yourself early and have something for later, I think, is just sort of gone. Are pitching injuries attributable to full-time max effort? Possibly. I know that length of game, to the extent Rob Manfred cares about it, which seems to be a lot, has a lot to do with it, because you take a longer amount of time between pitches when you're maxing up and amping up every single time. At the same time, if you speed people up and they're still throwing at max effort, they're going to get hurt. I think I've seen some study about that recently. So yeah, it's just very different. I don't want to play the old timer here, but if you go on YouTube and you find a game from 1987 or 1983 or something, you see guys catching the ball, throwing the ball, obviously not throwing at the level of max effort that we have now, but going longer into games. I guess the question is, are the hitters so good now that if someone came up there maxing out at 92 on their fastball for the first five innings, and then amped it up later. I mean, does the guy even get to five innings if he's only throwing 92? Probably. If he has a different approach, there are guys that don't have huge velocity that can still get it done. Bartolo Colon was doing pretty good the other day, and he's almost, well, actually, no, he's older than me. So, yeah, he's the last one older than me. I don't know. There are so many variables involved that I don't think a rule change. Rob Manfred is very big now on changing rules or making some declaration that's supposed to fix everything. It just doesn't work that way. Baseball is just a vast, complex organism that you start poking here and then you got to prod there. And there's just no way that you could do it all in one fell swoop. And what it's going to take is some organic internal change in baseball where someone figures out, hey, we don't need to carry 13 pitchers if we have four of them that can do this. And it might seesaw back, but it also might take 15 years. And my God, I'm going to be so old then. I don't even know if I'll care.
Well, they would get some roster spots back and it would be fun. I've said this many times to have Rafael Belliard types back or pinch runners back, yeah. or you know, a John Vanderwall kind of guy around who could come off the bench and get a big hit, Manny Mota, whoever. But it's harder, I think, to visualize those contingencies because they might come up every other game than it is the reliever, the left-handed specialist, because that's a situation you face every few innings possibly.
Yep. And you're not going to be able to force that change because if you just say in the next collective bargaining agreement, we're going to add a 26th or 25th, 26th roster spot, they're just going to put more pitchers on. I mean, that's just going to be a license for a manager to have one more relief arm.
Well, right. I've thought that many times too. So you would have to say, no, this is not a pitcher spot. You have to cap the number of pitchers.
Yeah.
I mean, the NFL does that with quarterbacks, say. You can't have more than three, and if you go to your third, you can't go back to the first. I don't know the rules, obviously, in the NFL as well, but I don't see that there's any reason you can't, even if you were allowed to give service time consideration. This is a sop to the union, and this is my fantasy baseball labor negotiation, yep, mogul simulation, that even if you designated 15 pitchers who were accumulating service time, that you couldn't say these 10 or even these five, because four of the five starters are not working on a given day, that these are the ones that you can use on Tuesday. Wednesday, you can name a different group, and you just liberalize the ability to taxi pitchers on and off the roster that way.
Oh, I think that's a fantastic idea. It would get complicated. You'd have to really get into it in a labor situation, but I think that's probably the best way to do it. We're going to have a couple things happen. We're going to have some relief pitcher having to go in and play shortstop in a game because there just aren't enough players. If that's happened yet, I don't remember it, but it'd be amazing, but it would also be like, holy crap, what are we doing with 14 pitchers on this team? But yeah, you setting your rosters before every game and not having to have guys be off of it for 7 days or whatever it is now, that would be useful. And it would be useful in more than one way. It'd be useful for injury purposes. I'm sure someone would try to game it, but you know, some Tony La Russa 2.0 would come along and all of a sudden make a mockery of it. But I'm willing to risk that. Tony La Russa had his good points too, so we can risk that. I don't know what they are, but I'm sure they're right.
He likes cats.
Oh, yeah. He's a cat guy. There you go. He likes animals. He likes cats. So there's Tony La Russa's good point.
He may drive drunk while with his cats, which is never a good idea.
Fluffy, take the wheel.
Better Fluffy than me. Yeah. One story they like to tell in my family is that I was taking one of my – I'm just telling you this as one cat guy to another – that I was taking one of my cats home from the vet one day and the cat seemed very unhappy in his carrier. And for a person who I hope is at least decently intelligent, I had a very low IQ moment. And I thought, well, it's kind of a quiet road. I can just let Fluffy out of the cage for the moment. And to make a long story short, I end up careening down this country road with four paws wrapped around my face as the cat was clinging to the back of my head. I'm not sure how it is I'm still here to tell the tale, but folks, don't do that. Leave Fluffy in the carrier if you're alone in the car.
Worst case scenario is always going to happen with a cat. Just assume the worst.
Oh, absolutely. And I knew that because, you know, my parents are phobic of flying, and we took these cross-country trips every summer with three cats in the car. And
oh my God,
it was difficult. Let's just leave it at that. But cats are not meant to do that. You wrote today about the Portland group
that is trying to buy up land for a ballpark site. They're going to build a ballpark speculatively, excuse me. They may not remember how well that went for Tampa for like 100 years that they had the empty ballpark that they now play in. I realize that that's sort of gibberish. At the same time, it's also true that they had an empty ballpark that they now play in that is an empty ballpark. But this ties into another aspect of the 2018 season, which is tanking. You were talking about how we could potentially have relocation or more likely, in your estimation, expansion in a couple of years just because the money will be too much for the owners to resist. But I had planned to ask you about this anyway, that at this early part of the season, and it is early, some of this will change, but the Orioles and Marlins are playing at a 48-114 pace. The Rays, I just mentioned, they're on a 38-124 pace. The White Sox, 46-116, which looks really normal compared to those guys. The Royals, 32-130. The Reds, 29-133. Also playing at 100-loss pace are the Rangers, Giants, and Padres. That's 9 teams, or almost a third of the whole. And again, whereas some of them will turn it around or at least even things out a little bit, because we know really even the 1962 Mets didn't lose 133 games in a season. I feel like at this moment, it does seem like the Reds are capable of that. But not all these teams are just having slow months. Some of them are not really trying and are not set up to try. And my question is, if we were to have expansion, and it would be fun to have expansion again, but is it not just a question that they're tanking and that there isn't sufficient talent to go around at the moment? Is it just that all the cool Ronald Acuñas are in the minor leagues? Or can we, in fact, support another couple of 25-man rosters?
I think we probably could. I'm not the best guy as far as hardcore analysis to ask about just what the sheer level of talent is out there in terms of metric tonnage of baseball players. But, you know, there are a lot of guys now who I think would still be playing if there were 50 new roster spots. You know, they're not great guys, but if we redistribute around the league a little bit, you figure that a lot of those, you know, 35, 36 year olds who are out of work right now would probably find somewhere. I mean, Brandon Phillips is one of the best baseball players on the planet. He's just not one of the best baseball players for the 30 teams that exist right now. Would he be for 32? Yeah, probably. I imagine he'd be playing second base somewhere. I tend to think that there is enough talent for that. I could be wrong about that. It might be ugly for a little while, but I don't know how it gets much uglier than what you just described. No, the Red Sox aren't going to win 140 games, and some of those, you know, wins are going to go to one of those teams that are on 130 loss pace right now. But what's happening, I don't think, is a function of there's not enough talent. What's happening is a clear philosophy about how you're going to build a team and how the, you know, what the timeline is for a team that's going to win. And more significantly, I think of what is the cost of a team losing in the short term to ownership. And that cost has gone way down over the years. The disparity between revenue and baseball success is getting bigger and bigger. You could be a really bad baseball team and not take too much of a hit, or not nearly as much of a hit as you used to if you were a losing, terrible team that no one wanted to watch, because gate is less important than it used to be, because you've got all these partnership deals and the official Winnebago of Major League Baseball and whatever, you know, bringing money in, and you're selling technology companies to Disney for $3 billion, and you're getting TV deals that are locked in for 20 years. And all of those things mitigate against having to win in the short term. Those priorities are whacked, man. And I know that if you did expansion, that would harm that even more, because that would infuse another couple of billion at least into major league coffers by virtue of the expansion fees that the new ownership groups would have to pay. But, you know, I think that more than overall talent level is the problem. We could do 32 teams. I'm convinced, actually. I don't think we would have 32 super teams. We wouldn't even have 10 super teams. We wouldn't have a bunch of, you know, teams for the ages. But people said that about, you know, expansion in the early 60s, the late 60s, the late 70s, the early 90s, and the late 90s. Every single time there's been the dilution argument, and it's never really been an issue, at least after a couple of years of evening things out. And if we've got the 1962 Mets right now in 5 or 6 places in the league without expansion, you know, what's the harm in trying to expand and see what happens?
Spring will be a little late this year. just a little late arriving in my lonely world over here. For you have left me, where is our April of old? Yes, you have left me, and winter continues cold, as if to say spring will be a little slow to start, a little slow reviving that music it made in my heart. Yes, time heals all things, I needn't cling to this fear. It's merely that spring will be just a little late this year.
You're listening to Bing Crosby sing Frank Lesser's 1944 composition, Spring Will Be a Little Late This Year. It fits perfectly, except that if your team is tanking, spring won't be late, it's just not coming at all. This song was debuted by the 40s musical star Deanna Durbin in her movie Christmas Holiday, and has been recorded by everyone from Ella Fitzgerald to Anita O'Day to Sarah Vaughan to Seth Freakin McFarlane. This version was recorded in 1976 and released on Bing's final album. The rest of the songs were recorded in September 77, and he died after a last round of golf that October 14th. In 1946, Bing bought a 25% stake in the Pittsburgh Pirates, and he held it the rest of his life. A word from our sponsors is incoming, so we'll take a quick break, and then Craig Calcaterra and I will be back with more conversation.
Time heals all things, so I needn't cling to the fear. It's merely that spring will be a little late this year, a little late.
In terms of those teams that have that record and it being a third of the league, and I don't know that any of the teams that I mentioned are going to turn around and be particularly competitive. Maybe the Giants are closest to that. At least people say they are. I don't see why they actually are looked at that way, other than that they have the history of being the successful Giants. But you were talking about having a hard time getting started with the 2018 season before. Do you find that this is an aspect of it? Because with this many teams not really making a full effort to win and not having a ton of attractive players on display, it rules out a whole lot of games. If, you know, I thanks to cable and various subscription services that MLB offers, most of us can watch most games any night. Ironically, I can't watch all the local games every night because I'm blacked out of three markets on any given day. But you can just rule out, oh, the Rays are playing the White Sox. That might be a good time to catch up on my reading. So do you find that alienating? Because
The concept is totally alienating. I think in practice in the first couple of weeks of the season, it hasn't been as bad as it could have because, I like everyone else, I think, picked the Yankees, the Indians, Houston, the Dodgers, the Cubs and the Nationals as sort of mega teams. I started calling them super teams because I have no imagination, but we figured that those would be the ones that would run away with it. And right now so far, you know, Boston, everyone thought would be good, but they're probably better than they, at least in the early going, than people thought. Seeing the Mets doing what they're doing is good. Pittsburgh's been playing tomato cans, so that's a big reason why they have 11 wins right now. But and then the Angels are interesting. I thought the Angels would be a playoff team this year. I call them a wild card team, but certainly in the early going, they've been even more exciting than their many roster moves in the offseason suggested they would be. So it could be way worse. I mean, if it was the five or six teams that everyone thought was going to be dominant this year doing exactly what they were supposed to be doing, it would be even worse. But I find myself wanting to, you know, watch the Mets a little bit, or I find myself making a point to watch the Angels, and that's good. But I think it's just saving what could have been a terrible, terrible situation, and it may still be if everyone evens out and plays to their talent level, and if we get to July and all the teams we expected to win have double-digit leads or something like that, it's going to be pretty brutal for the second half.
Well, we had no pennant races last year, really. It was over.
Yeah, wild card a little bit.
Yeah, but it was too much of it was over too soon. So I know what you mean. And just to circle back to what we were saying earlier, when we were talking about people being overly sympathetic to the management point of view and taking this kind of dry, well, that's the way you run a baseball team point of view. What about the aspect of being a baseball fan or just being a consumer and saying as a Reds fan, I don't accept this. I don't want to deal with this. Like, or for that matter, as a Braves fan, do you want to see the best Braves team that, and I'm not picking the Braves pointedly because you're a Braves fan, but because they have Acuña. And the thing is that if they can play a better lineup than they're playing right now, and fortunately for them, their outfield has played pretty well so far. So he wasn't necessarily going to replace Ender Enciante, who is the one outfielder they have who's scuffling. But if any team could play a better lineup than they're playing now, but choose not to, I don't see why you're not as insulted as, say, if you went to a restaurant and they could serve you a better cut of meat, but chose to serve you government surplus. I mean, it doesn't make sense as a fan, even if you understand it from a management point of view, to say, I'm going to pay the same money for this product or spend my valuable time watching this product that I know has been watered down.
Oh, it pisses me off to no end. And it's one of the things that's what I was talking about, that exact dilemma there is where I find myself butting heads with a lot of my readers, where it's impossible for them to see outside of the, well, this is the smart baseball thing to do, as opposed to me saying, well, look, but it's not fun. I'd rather see a more fun team. I'd rather see the best team now, even if it means in 5 years, someone has to make a hard decision or spend a little bit more money for Ronald Acuña. But I think it's also important for us to take a step back and realize that, or at least me, the people I talk to are hardcore baseball obsessives. They're people that come to my blog and comment on it or talk to me on Twitter and everything. And I am too. I've been trying to take a step further out of that and think of, okay, I'm a dad and I've got a couple little kids and I can only afford to take my kids to a couple of games this year. And we're going to go to one maybe in late April, early May. But the team doesn't have its best players there because of, you know, roster construction. What does that guy care about that? I mean, or, you know, how does we may win more in 2022 translate to an 11-year-old kid who wants to see the local team win today? That's all that matters to them. That is literally all that matters. The mid-80s Braves were terrible, but when I turned on a game on TBS, I wanted them to win that day. I knew they were terrible, but I wanted to see, we consume games, we consume baseball on a game-by-game basis, not on a seven-year success cycle basis. Some of us do. I mean, a lot of us have gotten ourselves into a baseball echo chamber where we only think in terms of those kind of things and those considerations. But most people don't consume baseball that way. And I think it's incumbent upon a team within reason to put the best product out there every day. And if you're the Reds right now, I'll admit I don't have any idea of what the Reds farm system looks like at the moment. But if I'm the Reds right now and I'm a Reds fan, I'm insulted at what they're expecting me to go see. Now, of course, I'm going to go down to a Reds game like in 2 weeks because I'm just hopeless, but the Braves are going to be in town. So that's why I'm going. I think that that's a big problem as far as interest level for Major League Baseball. And again, since there's a detachment between gate and that real basic fan experience and how much money these guys are making off of all these other sorts of revenue streams, I don't know that they're understanding that they could be eroding a lot of interest in a lot of markets in baseball.
Not to be overly morbid, but I don't know how anyone who is a fan of a team can sit back and say, well, they'll be good in 2022. I think it was John Maynard Keynes who talked about in the long run, well, in the long run, we're all dead. And yes, it would just be an irony if you hung up the phone to your – people don't hang up phones anymore, but you get the idea. If you clicked off the phone on your local call-in show supporting the Braves for sending Ronald Acuña out to the boondocks, at which point the tractor trailer plowed through your living room and plowed you under. I mean, how many –
Cubs fans, between how many funerals between 1908 and 2016 did people go to and say, if only Grandpa had lived to see the Cubs win the World Series, he really thought those Ryan Sandberg teams were going to make it. Poor Grandpa. Like, you might not ever get there. And there are no guarantees they might not ever get there either. How many years did it take the Royals? Over 20 years.
We've screwed up in a lot of ways. And when I say we, I mean those of us involved in the baseball discourse over the last 15 years or whatever, in that the conversation that you and I are very close to going into, if we pushed ourselves a little bit into self-parody here, we could be having the old school talk radio gab fest about the Reds don't care. They don't give a crap about the fan. Why should you pay your hard-earned money to go see the Reds when they're just bums and they don't give a crap about you? And, you know, you have that whole thing. And a wise person, me, circa 2003, would say, well, there are a lot of reasons why the Reds aren't good right now and they're building for the future and everything. And that was a very reasonable conversation to have then. And it is a reasonable conversation to have now if everyone's being sane. But the bang your fist on the table, the team should put out the best product, it's an entertainment product, and the fans are getting shortchanged position is so easily mockable because it was so mock-worthy for so long in that it wasn't informed. And if you have an informed take that sort of echoes that old school talk radio take, I don't know how I'm supposed to get my readers to take me seriously if I put that on. They'll think I'm putting them on. And that's been the hardest thing I've been trying to figure out how to do over the last year or two, is push back away from the baseball analysis side of things, or the, you know, as I referred to myself as a, and you have too, as a fellow traveler or the liberal arts wing or whatever of sabermetrics, to move away from that and try to be more of a fan advocate and try to think of baseball as a product and just one of many pursuits that human beings in the United States can get interested in. And it doesn't have to be baseball. It's very difficult to make that shift and not find yourself sort of echoing the old school columnist we all used to mock, or the old school radio guy who's become, you know, obsolete. And finding that sweet spot is sort of the biggest battle I have had lately. And I find it interesting, and I'm trying to find ways to couch those arguments that don't sound like I'm some old fogey who just completely had a spring bust in his brain.
Well, the thing is, it's always been circumstantial. There's no one-size-fits-all rule here, in that if we look at these teams, like, we could give the White Sox the benefit of the doubt. The White Sox traded their whole roster for some great prospects, mm-hmm. and they may or may not get back to the World Series anytime soon. But you can't say, even if they lose 116 games this year, as they're on a pace to do, again, we shouldn't take that pace that seriously in the early going, but say they do, you can't say they weren't trying
right.
to improve that club, and that we at this moment have to take them at their word that when they get a little closer, if that year's Manny Machado is out there or Bryce Harper in the free agent pool, that they won't go for it. They might go for it at that point. But the Reds, and I don't mean to just stigmatize the Reds, we could say the Marlins too, although again, let's give Derek Jeter the benefit of the doubt too, that he's going to burn this thing down to the ground. He certainly has, and that they are going to make a sincere effort to rebuild. But I saw someone in some article the other day refer to the Reds as in year five of a deep rebuild, and I thought, what evidence of do you have of that? Because there have been years throughout this period, they've just opted not to have a starting rotation.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't mean not to have a starting rotation in the sense that teams are bullpenning. I mean, just we will not do this. We will just, it's soup du jour every day. Whatever was in the back of the refrigerator that morning is what we're putting out on the mound. And so it's never one thing. It's always, there are always some teams tanking. And I'll give you an even older fogey example of that. Connie Mack said, and this was not reported during his lifetime, but after, he said that for him, the best season was one in which the team got hot early and then died, because it got the fans excited and buying tickets for a while. And then once the team died, you didn't have to give any of the players any raises because they all had bad seasons. And that's an incredibly cynical way to go about doing this baseball thing, at least in terms of sincerely servicing your fan base. But I feel like that is what we're seeing. And I don't think there's anything like get off my lawnish retrograde thinking about that.
I think there's a middle ground that no one really discusses because it doesn't really fit in either sabermetric orthodoxy or baseball man orthodoxy, as maybe we would have called it a few years back. If you're the Marlins or if you're the White Sox and you're burning it all down because you just didn't have a good foundation and you're trading away your good players and you're getting prospects and stuff, okay, I can see that. That's a totally legitimate thing to do. What you do in the meantime, though, I think matters. And I think maybe it used to not be a choice. Maybe it really was. We can only afford to do so much because we got to save money or whatever because we're going to lose and we can't put a winning short-term major league team on the field while we're also growing our farm system. But I think everyone has just wrongfully accepted the idea that you have to have a crap major league product while you're rebuilding in the farm. You know, I think back to, like, again, I'll go back just to what I'm familiar with, like the 86 Braves. They're terrible, right? And they really didn't even start rebuilding until Bobby Cox came in the late 80s, like 87 was when they made the John Smoltz trade and stuff. And yeah, they had Tom Glavine in the system, but it was not really rebuilding in a proper way. But they were just a bad, bad baseball team, 85, 86, 87. But you know what? They had guys I wanted to watch. Ted Simmons was on those teams. Chris Chambliss was on those teams. They weren't good anymore. They were over the hill. But, you know, seeing Ken Griffey Sr. play left field for the Braves, they were names. I knew them from baseball cards. I knew them from the baseball books that I read. They were interesting. They were still competitive. They weren't great, but they were good. They were recognizable. And it was a decent baseball product, sort of. I think those the team that had Ken Griffey and Ted Simmons probably won like 70 games or something. But I felt like I was watching a major league product. I didn't feel like I was watching something that was just completely putrid, like what the Marlins are trying to perpetrate right now. And there are a lot of mid-level guys who aren't going to be, to use the phrase, part of the next winning Marlins team, who probably could be better choices and more exciting players and better players than what, say, the Marlins or the White Sox or the Reds or whatever are putting out there, that are out of a job because they just figure, well, why should I pay this guy $1 million when I can pay a kid $500,000 and will only win 3 or 4 more games? Well, because someone might be more interested in seeing, again, Brandon Phillips, or someone might be more interested in seeing an Adam Lind or somebody like that than seeing, you know, some anonymous guy who isn't going to be there. And I know that's a very difficult case to make of a famous name as opposed to, a good baseball player or a marginally better baseball player. I don't know, but there's some sweet spot that's got to be in between. We're tearing it all down and we're going to accept 115 losses versus, win or bust.
Can I just say, I was looking at the 86 Braves as you were talking, and you're right, they won 76 games or something like that.
Well, that many, I'm shocked.
72 games. In fact, I remember this team very well, just like you, less from watching and more through baseball cards. And it's the only reason I remember guys like Cliff Speck. If you said Cliff Speck to me today, what my brain would kick back is serial killer, right? Murdered a bunch of student nurses in Chicago in the late 60s. I apologize to Cliff Speck. He just happens to share a surname with one of those unfortunate individuals. But the thing about that team, that if we were writing about it today, I just want to throw out this one aspect of it, because you're right. They had a lot of quality players. They had Ozzie Virgil at catcher, Bob Horner at first. Glenn Hubbard was a really good glove at second base. Ken Obergefell was at least a decent hitter. In some years, he walked a lot. Griffey Sr. came over from the Yankees that year and was fine or good, actually. And Dale Murphy was still in his prime. But for whatever reason, they couldn't keep a right fielder healthy that year. And so the guy who took the most turns as the starting right fielder was Omar freaking Moreno. And for people who don't remember, Omar Moreno was with the Pirates for forever and bounced around to some other teams at the end of his career. He was the guy that Bill James called the symbol of futility because he was a leadoff man with no on-base percentage. He also had no power, and he, as his career went on, didn't steal bases at a great percentage either. So the starting...
Yeah, that was his only calling.
Right.
It was stealing bases.
Exactly. So the starting right fielder for the Braves that year hit... And again, it's starting in about a third of the games because they didn't really have a regular guy there. But in 118 games, he hit 234 with a 276 on base, a .351 slugging percentage. He made 33 attempts on the base paths, and he was caught 16 times. So it says 17 stolen bases, 16 caught stealing. Could you imagine we would be ripping the Braves 24/7 just for that bit of sabermetric heresy, putting that guy in the corner outfield?
Well, thank you. You're giving me like PTSD now from these Braves teams. I would have, if you put a gun to my head, I would have guessed that a Renicky was involved, but that might have been the following season. You get Gary Renicky or somebody to shore up right field, even though he probably couldn't even walk at that point. But yeah, but you know what? Those were fun teams. And I'm not just saying it because I was 13 in 1986. I mean, I found them fun because, you know, I even then I do remember now Omar Marino playing, and I remember him not being good because I was probably keying on batting average, and I was probably noticing how often he got caught stealing, even though I wasn't hip yet to the idea of, you know, your stolen base rate and on-base percentage and all that. But I remember thinking, wow, he sucks, but it's kind of fun. And wasn't he good? And then I grabbed my you know, baseball cards, and I'd find my 1979 Omar Marino. I'm like, hey, he was good. Maybe he wasn't all that good. It was fun. It was diverting. I mean, it wasn't like some random quad A guy who is up there who I'm never going to see again and no one else is ever going to see again. And I can't even relate in any way. I mean, I could relate to Ken Obergefell. I could relate to, you know, Ken Griffey or Chris Chambliss in a way that gave me entertainment, even if it was, you know, gallows humor or whatever. I just can't relate to a right field shuttle of a couple of 27-year-olds who, you know, played a little bit in Mexico and then are just, you know, roster filler now, and until, you know, 5 years from now the young stud we just drafted last summer is up. I don't know how that holds somebody's interest. Maybe I'm just too beholden to recognizable names in baseball card baseball, but I enjoyed those back then. Maybe it's a testament to how little of a life I had in the mid to late 80s. I don't know.
I'll also throw in that he led off with that .276 OBP 66 games. And that was an improvement for the Braves in some sense, because in other years they let off Rafael Ramirez, who was as bad or worse. But he was a shortstop. And in those days, if you didn't have Ricky Henderson,
Chuck Tanner won a World Series with Omar Moreno at the top of his lineup. How dare you think that lightning is not going to strike like 7 or 8 years later?
You're right. I mean, and that was Chuck Tanner. He was trying to recapture something. You know, managers play their favorites, and I think Chuck Tanner, being the kind of guy Chuck Tanner was certainly that.
Spring this year has got me feeling like a horse that never left the post. I lie in my room, staring up at the ceiling. Spring can really hang you up the most. Morning's kiss wakes trees and flowers, and to them I'd like to drink a toast. I stroll in the park just to kill lonely hours. Spring can really hang you up the most.
You're listening to Carmen McRae sing the standard Spring Can Really Hang You Up the Most. The song was written in 1955 by Fran Landesman and Tommy Wolfe, and has been covered by all the same people that I listed during our previous break. I don't think I have to explain why this one seemed like a good fit for today's show. This version is from 1964. We'll take a quick break, whoever we is, and then I'll be back to wrap up my conversation with Craig Calcaterra. Stick around, won't you?
Love seems sure around the new year. Now it's April, love is just a ghost. Spring arrived on time, but what became of you, dear? Spring can really hang you up the most.
I'll also throw out that those games were fun because I saw a fair share of those, because since nobody went to Atlanta Fulton County Stadium at that time, the crowd mic
had more noise coming from the field than from the stands.
Oh, yeah.
So you could hear the players talking to each other, every cuss word and dadgummit when they popped up, and or just, hey, how you doing? That kind of thing. You could hear everything that they said during those Braves games.
I think that's a TBS thing, or was a TBS thing when it was only the Braves, because even when they were good in the early 90s, when they started to draw and they were, you know, going to the playoffs and stuff, I always thought the TBS mics were hotter than the mics on all the other broadcasts. And, you know, mostly I remember this because Greg Maddux would always drop an F-bomb whenever, you know, he missed his target by a millimeter or something. He was the captain of just yelling, you know, F at the top of his lungs. It was great. That's how I came to baseball. I mean, I was a Tigers fan in the late 70s and early 80s, but I was really, really young, and I was more listening on the radio and stuff, and I was trying to get into it. But like, my baseball is my life, and I'm going to sit every day and watch a baseball game, and I'm going to think hard about it all the time, really developed in the mid 80s. And it developed with those Braves teams, and it developed watching games where there were 7,000 people maybe in the stands on a good day, and it was terrible. I loved it. It's miserable. Dane Perry wrote that article a week or so ago about the White Sox ballpark situation. If you haven't read it, go find it at CBS.com. Dane Perry wrote a thing about the Chicago White Sox ballpark situation in the late 80s before they built New Comiskey, the ballpark they could have built. And in the early going, in the intro, he puts himself in whatever they call that now, guaranteed rate field, late last season in an empty park. And he uses some phrase like the something zen of an empty ballpark for a losing team or something. And it's like, he captured it absolutely perfectly. And I don't know anybody else who has ever captured that as well as the feeling that I had in my head watching those mid to late 80s Braves teams.
I will, just to contradict you on one thing, when you're talking about that shuttle in right field with one guy who was in the Mexican League last year, and maybe that's not as interesting as a named player. One of the things I really like about what the Cardinals started doing last year and are doing now is that the two leading hitters on their team at the moment, and I don't know if this will last, but one is Jose Martinez, who's 29 and hasn't been around more than 2 minutes, and the other is Tommy Pham, who is 30 and hasn't been around for more than 2 minutes and doesn't want you to forget that because he's pissed.
Yes.
That he's only been around for 2 minutes. But if you go back to, you know, the period of baseball history that I often dwell in, the 20s, 30s, 40s, you have these guys, for some reason, another Cardinals first baseman, Ripper Collins, comes to mind, guys who were stuck in the minors for forever because maybe scouting wasn't what it is now, and guys just got missed, or players were making a good living in the Pacific Coast League and literally didn't want to come up because they were going to take a pay cut. And so you would have these guys who would come up at 28, 29, have 3-4 good years and disappear again. And you can only wonder, if they had had full careers, would they have been Hall of Famers? Would they be better remembered today? And I feel like Jose Martinez and Tommy Pham are throwbacks to that period. And it's gratifying to see guys who are not first round draft picks, super touted prospects, finding their way into a major league lineup and making good.
That's true. I don't know if Pham is the best example of that, just because his situation is so weird, in that I think there was a political issue there partially, in that he was one of Walt Jocketty's last draft picks. And when the new administration came in, I think there was this whole idea of, we're going to discount what came before, and we're going to give guys like Piscotty and, you know, people that we drafted higher a better look. So maybe it doesn't matter the reasons. And then he got hurt too for a little while when he was in the minors. I think in any other organization, and if he had avoided that injury, he probably would have been thought of as, this is a prospect, this is a guy who's going to make it. But I get what you're saying with that, in that there can be a good story with these guys. I don't know that I described it perfectly when I'm thinking about, you know, the right field shuttle and the Mexican League guy. There's something about a player that is simultaneously not interesting but not good that is really bad. I will take bad and interesting. I will take good and bland. But both bad and bland is just bad for me. And I couldn't even tell you right now who's playing corner outfield in Miami. But my guess is that the fact that I can't probably means that he's boring. And I guess that's what bugs me. I'd rather see some color. I'd rather see something. I'd rather see a guy who used to be good, or a guy who had an interesting history, or, you know, someone that Vin Scully could tell a great story about, even if he was hitting nothing, instead of sort of just an anonymous organizational soldier who gives boring quotes. But that's more on me than on baseball. So
one of them is Cameron Maybin, and, you know, he's
okay. He's interesting. He's done stuff.
Right. And he's a former first round draft pick, 10th overall. So even though he's 31 and has had every injury under the sun, short of severe amputation or something, this could be the year. This could be the year that he finally puts it all together in year 13 of his major league career.
That's true. Okay. So they got Brinson. Brinson is a prospect. So we'll give him that. He's terrible right now, but he's a prospect. I don't know. I don't have any strong feelings about Derek Dietrich. I don't know if – should I have strong feelings? Maybe I just haven't watched enough Marlins games. Just not as interesting enough for me. Mabin's going to carry the day, though, just because he's the guy who, when he went to San Diego, started making fun of Panda Express for giving him diarrhea, and he didn't realize that the team owner had an interest in Panda Express, like was on their board or something. So that's the kind of face plant that is always going to endear Cameron Mabin to me because, man, we've all been there.
See, the guy who – just to use the Marlins as an example, since I have their roster in front of me, the guy where I have that reaction that you were talking about, oh, not this again – and nothing against him, because again, I like to see guys persevere. I like to see them come back. But J.B. Shuck was just called up by them as a reserve outfielder. And Shuck is 31, and we know what he can do. He's been around on and off going back to 2011. He's not particularly great even as a fourth or fifth outfielder, if teams even have fifth outfielders now. He's just a placeholder. He's neither like great veteran pickup who you can exploit some value from or a youngster on the make. He's just there. And it's
right.
If I went to a Marlins game, not that there's any danger of that happening, but if I went to a team that was winning, if I went to a Mets game, it's weird to say that, but let's say, you know, I go to the Mets game and the opposing team, you know, right fielder, J.B. Shuck, I'd be like, you know, like that's the time to go to the concession stand.
Yeah. Yeah. I've put the offseason in the back of my mind somewhere now, but I'm pretty sure that there were 10 outfielders who weren't that expensive that the Marlins could have gotten that would at least be more interesting than J.B. Shuck. There had to have been. But they had J.B. Shuck, right? Or he wasn't someone that cost even a dime to have. Could there have been a more interesting option than J.B. Shuck? I'm guessing, yeah. And that there was no interest in it at all, mostly because the Marlins owners have severe debt service obligations, is not exactly a way to build a baseball fan base.
So as we wrap up here, we have a bit of breaking Braves news. It's a bit of weird Braves news, but they have signed veteran outfielder and multi-position player Jose Bautista, 37, to a deal. I don't know if it's major or minor. He's going off to extended spring training. They apparently plan to let him play third base, which he hasn't done regularly since, I don't know, the Reagan administration. Yeah, 2007, 2008, something like that. Not that he was great at that. It seems odd that he would suddenly become Brooks Robinson at 37, but the Braves have had a lot of trouble filling the third base position for literally, it feels like, years. It's like the curse of Chipper Jones or something.
Oh, yeah.
So how do you...
Well, you know what? I love it. Look, this is okay. I'm hearing this news from you because, you know, I live on Twitter, but I'm not on it now. So I didn't see that until you just mentioned it. And I hadn't considered it even once because I thought Bautista would be done. And I never thought that someone would sign him to play third base. But I'm sitting here right now and I've probably watched, you know, 8 Braves games or 10 Braves games so far. And I'm thinking, okay, that's a good third base option. Not because I think Jose Bautista is any good anymore, but because that's fun to watch. I will turn on the next Braves game, that at least once Jose Bautista is there, eagerly wanting to see what happens, wanting to see how it works. And also secure in the knowledge that if the Braves had Jose Bautista last year, he probably would have been like second on the team in homers or something. I mean, that's what they've been dealing with. Even decrepit, almost dead Jose Bautista would have been an improvement for this team last year. And there's no way whatsoever that he's going to be on this team 2 years from now. But darn it, I want the team to be interesting now, and I would like to see him hit a big home run so I could say 20 years from now, when people are talking about Jose Bautista's career, I could say, remember that weird last half season he played with Atlanta? Yeah, that was fun. That's cool. I like it. You know what? It's risky.
I can't argue with that. I was actually going to mention this to you anyway, but related to that, the guy who is at his normal position, right field, is Nick Markakis. He's in the last year of his contract. He's 34. He has to be one of the weirdest players of all time in that this is a guy who, and we can't be sure that he gets another contract, because if we have another offseason like last offseason, maybe nobody ever.
He's the kind of guy that doesn't sign.
Yeah, exactly. But he could finish this year with 2,200 hits at age 34. And this is a player who peaked at 24. Or at 23, he's had some good seasons and bad, but has not been in the slightest danger of making an all-star team or doing anything else notable basically in a decade. As a Brave to this moment, as the starting right fielder, it's a really weird line, 279, 357 on base, 387 slugging. He's just a weird, neither fish nor fowl. He's sort of the McRib sandwich of baseball, I
think. he is so frustrating as a Braves fan, because for the reason you mentioned, are there worse players than Nick Markakis? Yes. Are there worse players that get the playing time that he gets? No, not really. Albert Pujols, but he's a different beast. And I think I saw someone say that maybe even today I saw Pujols and Alcides Escobar are the only two worse hitters with some minimum playing time or average, you know, plate appearances per season, regular everyday players whose position is not questioned. Markakis is like the third worst in all of baseball over the last 5 years or something like that. At any given time, though, he could be fine. And I find myself getting into Nick Markakis traps. I'll tweet about Nick Markakis, and I'll see Freddie Freeman getting an intentional walk, and then I'll tweet something snarky about, oh, well, here comes his protection, Nick Markakis. And then Markakis will like slash a double, and I feel like an idiot. He's got the secret. Every team, I think, fan base has the joke where, you know, he's the one who has the pictures. It used to be, you know, Keith Lockhart had some incriminating pictures of Bobby Cox, and that's why he got all the playing time. Nick Markakis has incriminating pictures of probably the entire board of Liberty Media, which is keeping him from being released or something. But you know what? I would love Jose Bautista to come in, to have his first series be an interleague game. So they stick him at DH. He hits like three homers, and Nick Markakis has a mild, certainly not painful, I don't want anything bad to happen to Markakis as a human being, but some sort of injury that shelves him for a while. They put Bautista in right field for the rest of the season, and we see the last of Nick Markakis, and we see the last hurrah of Jose Bautista, and the Braves are interesting. That's what I'm going to wish for. That's my season goal for the Atlanta Braves.
It strikes me that if Markakis were a second baseman, his career would be totally explicable, because we expect those guys to peak early and then to fade mm-hmm. pretty quickly. Lots of second basemen have done that. It's like the Roberto Alomar story. And if you just pretend that as a Brave, like I said, he's walked 70 times a year, he's hit 35 doubles, he just hasn't really had much in the way of batting average or power. If you pretended that was a middle infielder and that the Braves signed him off of this, you know, pretty great career for a second baseman in Baltimore and just got a disappointing returns in a, as I said, Alomar, Carlos Baerga kind of way, it would make total sense and you wouldn't feel disappointed in him at all. You'd just go, hey, that's baseball.
Yeah, absolutely. I was trying to think if he was a guy, the sort of guy who, if he had played in the 70s, everybody would think of as a big star or whatever. But the fact that his batting average has never been spectacular sort of mitigates against that. It's the weirdest career. Part of the reason why the Braves even picked him up and assumed his salary and gave him that extension was because they were tearing down stuff. And I think they wanted to avoid grievances and things like that. So they just gave him a big bunch of money. I mean, he's lived a pretty charmed baseball life based on his production.
Craig, I want to thank you for coming by again. This is your third time here, and it's always great to talk to you and hear what's going on in Ohio. It occurred to me that when Cliff Corcoran is here, I always introduce him as the man of 1,000 baseball caps, which is only slight hyperbole by 900 baseball caps or so. But in your case, I could have said you were the man of 1,000 baseball cats, and I am really regretting that I didn't do that now, but that's the only regret that I have, because this was a great conversation.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's always fun.
by Thor's vitamin E deficiency, we have come to the end of another episode. You can follow Craig Calcaterra on Twitter at Craig Calcaterra. Calca and the planet, you know, Terra. As for me, you can follow me at Go Stephen Goldman. Why Go Stephen Goldman? Because Lo Stephen Goldman sounds comically biblical, and it's never a good idea to put comical and biblical together unless you want to reap the whirlwind. You can also write us at infiniteinning@gmail.com, and please rate us at Apple, iTunes, or Stitcher, or the podcatcher of your choice, or just tell a friend, tell mom, word of mouth helps too. We have a sponsor now, but nevertheless, this episode is brought to you by the number 19. Our producer is Chip54, a semi-intelligent android from the past. Our theme song was a co-composition of myself and Dr. Rick Mooring, who as a physicist knows that x plus y does not necessarily equal the negation of x by y. X soldiers on, even if it is just plunged into a black hole. Well, if Mookie Betts doesn't homer into the bleachers just as the vendor has brought my plate of lobster thermidor, causing me to spill it on the ghost of Albert Gallatin, I'll be back next week with more tales and discussion from inside the Infinite Inning.